To say that healthcare in South Africa is in crisis would be an understatement. Despite a thriving and efficient private healthcare system, over 80% of the population has virtually no access to decent healthcare, something that is a basic human right. And with no end in sight to the legacy of poor governance, deteriorating infrastructure, and a severe shortage of skills as well as essential medical supplies, it really is hard to see the situation improving anytime soon. So what interventions are needed to overcome historic social and economic inequality and change the course of healthcare in South Africa? Is the answer to be found in the NHI approved by Parliament last year, or will this initiative only serve to cripple an already limping healthcare sector? I'm Jeremy Maggs. This is No Ordinary Wednesday. It's our in-depth look at what's driving markets, shaping the economy, and changing the game. In this episode, we'll explore the formidable challenges to creating more equitable access to healthcare in South Africa. I am joined by activist and founder of the Progressive Health Forum, Dr. Aslam Dasu, along with Investec healthcare equity analyst Letlotlo Lenake. Both of my guests were expert panelists at the recent inaugural Investec Health Beat Conference, a critical dialogue whose purpose is to build a better future for healthcare in South Africa. In the words of Richard Wainwright, Executive Director of Investec South Africa, it's about working together for a common purpose. Let's have a listen.
For Investec, why the healthcare sector? Why the focus on this? For me, thinking back on it during COVID, I had the privilege to lead the banking association at that time, and we had a lot of engagements with government and in particular with the president as well, in dealing with that particular crisis. When we got together as South Africans, we were able to make an impact. And I think certainly from the business perspective, we learned a lot about the sector and its challenges. So through engagement amongst ourselves, we said we have access to various stakeholders in this industry, both public, private, medical aides, private groups, suppliers, industry experts, industry leaders, thought leaders. Why don't we bring people together to try and solve some of these problems through dialogue? That's an important sector for us. It affects every single South African. Collectively, we know the challenges are ginormous. We know that we have financial constraints, but yet we know that if we work together, we can succeed. Let's try and get the issues on the table, and together we'll find the solutions.
So what will it take to effect real change in the healthcare sector? To both of you, a very warm welcome to No Ordinary Wednesday. And Dr. Dasu, Richard Wainwright, as you've just heard, speaks about finding solutions to the challenges in healthcare. So what are we solving for? What are the big challenges facing the healthcare system in South Africa? And how did we get there?
Look, I think if we're going to discuss the problems, healthcare is unfortunately not a snapshot in time. There's deep context to the situation you face right now. Most people will approach the question that you've just posed with, okay, so here we have this, 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 and this. But all of these things have had deep-rooted development. And that explains in many ways where we are and what we have to do to fix it. So when you take the previous way of doing it, okay, this is the problem, here's what we have to do to fix it, you tend to forget who got us here. And, you know, in the health system, the who is very important. It's not just a system of remote policies, okay? And, you know, very briefly, if I can just put that context forward, then we can understand why we've arrived where we have. And that is because, of course, we've got a legacy of a social and a political and an economic system that has impacted on how healthcare has developed over the last 100 years here, with a remarkable difference that despite that, because of the post-war years, a national health system developed. So even in the broken-up apartheid state, Bantustans, everything, where it was all racialized, public health systems developed. And then post-94, what was clear was that these could be integrated because they represented collectively the most distributed health system on the continent, if not in the Southern Hemisphere. Over the years, that had just been something that had developed. And our health policies, which were developed in the 80s, you know, in part of the liberation movement and when we opened up the front against apartheid healthcare, by the time we came to 1997, there was a comprehensive, clear health policy, taking into account the current situation in 97, globally, economically, in South Africa, and so on, and a very smart approach, which recognized that we have a private system and a public system, small private system, but which was of a sufficient quality to be very useful. And so what you wanted was a gradual integration to create one system which would leave the private system profitable for those who wish to use it, and a public system which would cater for the 90% of the rest of the population, which is still who use the proportion of the population that uses the public system. And so what happens? Naturally, there's the integration initially, which is all good. So now we've got one public health system from all the various bits and pieces. But the private system continues to grow. It's highly efficient. People want to go there. But after 2000, 2003, what you get is a decline in the management of the public system. And so what happens then is that despite the fact that you have constitutional access to healthcare, constitutional entitlement, what you're finding is reduced access, despite the fact that in the Mandela administration, we built 1,000 primary healthcare facilities in one of the largest ever clinic building programs in the world, which brought healthcare for the first time to almost every South African within 10 kilometers of their doorstep. So you had that, but then there was a decline in that. So the systems that you put in place or the clinics that were there started to become derelict. And as people focused on the politics, somehow that fell through. And what we noticed was a dramatic decline in the management of our top facilities. So we have these great teaching hospitals and secondary and tertiary facilities. And what you noticed was a migration of personnel first and then patients as well. Now, before 94, the middle classes used to use the public health system, you know, so white hospitals were well-resourced, very well serviced by personnel and so on. But now there was one administration, which we hoped would improve the administration in the former black hospitals, which was not so bad, but it could have been done. But then there was a general steady decline so that people did not feel comfortable being treated in the public system. Some felt unsafe, and this grew rapidly. So the middle classes moved out, and the private sector grew, was always receptive to them. Now, at the moment, you have half of your specialists, if not more, working in the private sector, now which caters to the small middle class, right? And what you have in the primary sector is that people paying out of pocket for GPs, effectively, but anything else, they then resort to the public system, which is the system of first and ultimate resort. Now, the biggest problem, I think, occurred at the political level, where there was this mix of ideology and control freakery with a constitutional quirk that makes healthcare provincial competence. And now you've got these fiefdoms in these provinces. So what you have is good policies at the top, interpreted in 9 different ways, very badly. But they took away, they disempowered the clinical cohort. Your doctors and nurses and pharmacists are trained for years and years and years. 9 years for doctors. But they train to optimize the delivery platform. That's what you do when you are there. Instead, they gave that function to the clerks, the administrators, those who know nothing about healthcare. And so those two things, the political, ideological bent that there must be no private healthcare and the management of the public system were so dysfunctional, and of course that allows corruption to come in, that there's no surprise that your public hospitals are now in a state of grave decline.
You are not going to hear a better context or outline to where we stand right now with the healthcare crisis in South Africa. So, Letlotlo, building on that, if you can, and let's bring you into the conversation. We now know what the reality is for millions of people across the country. Let's look at this through an economic lens, if we can, and the impact of inadequate and at times complete lack of healthcare in the country. What has your research told you?
Just to start off, the economic impact from a lack of healthcare resources or lack of healthcare delivery, in essence, can be, you know, largely negative in my view. Because as a result of that, you know, you have lower productivity in some of your staff through absenteeism. You get increased healthcare costs over time because people potentially are not treating, you know, preventable diseases or diseases that can easily be treated, or they come across as or presenting with these high acuity cases that in essence could have been preventable at the start. If you don't, in essence, have a system where people can access healthcare at an appropriate level and at an affordable level, you potentially could get people who get into a poverty trap where your out-of-pocket expenditure, you know, jumps up quite significantly, where people are having to take out exorbitant amount of costs to potentially pay for these exorbitant healthcare costs. You know, and just and then over the longer term, also thinking about it, you get a potential increased burden on the government where they have to fork out some of these significant cost to make sure that the population, in essence, or to take out significant subsidies for the poor, or to make sure that the population has a relevant or adequate level of healthcare from that perspective. And then even if you're thinking about that, there are, it spills off over into other economic industries. If you're thinking about from a tourism and a trade perspective, what does that do for investor sentiment? Do investors want to put money into, you know, potential countries that have poor healthcare services, and especially for industries that have a high reliance on your staff or the potential of your staff? And what happens to your staff who aren't able to be active? You know, what happens to them even before, like I said before, from an absenteeism perspective, from a productivity perspective? It doesn't send the right signals from that perspective, and it is largely negative.
So we hear all the time about a collaborative approach as far as this is concerned, and the phrase that is bandied about all the time is public-private partnership. And as elegant as that might sound, there is still inherent risk attached to that model, because as Dr. Aslam Dasu was referring to a little earlier, you know, 90% there or thereabouts of people still depending on the public sector for healthcare.
So let me maybe speak about the private sector's role in healthcare delivery from that perspective. From a service delivery perspective, if you're looking at where doctors or GPs or some specialist services, a lot of that comes through in where the healthcare services are mainly provided in urban areas. So you could have an issue there where people say, well, maybe there's an access to care issue, where maybe some people who in some of the urban areas are getting preferential access versus people who sit in rural areas. You know, the private sector is also very much responsible for innovation and driving some of that within the greater healthcare industry, because that's where they're incentivized to do it. Whereas that potentially doesn't take place in the public sector. On top of that, so even jumping on that, you know, from a cost containment perspective, you could even say, well, in theory, the private sector should be driving down costs, but maybe some of the incentives that the private sector faces are very much at a difference to what the public sector is sort of incentivized. So you could say, well, there's a very much a clear profit motive within the private sector that everyone is trying to push this fee-for-service, you know, kind of environment we have, especially in the South African context, whereas in theory, the more people that you drive into the system should be bringing costs down. But there's maybe a balance of risk, and the way that people incentivize in the public and the private sector are kind of misaligned. Right?
So Dr. Aslam Dasu, back to you. Profit is always going to be a driving philosophy as far as the private sector is concerned. So if the public-private partnership is one way of doing it, how do you achieve an equitable parity there?
With great difficulty, if at all. And that's simply because there's no singularity of interest here. So you've got a public system that's tax-funded, okay, where the staff is employed, where there's no financial incentive for care, okay? So you do the care that is necessary, or you provide the care that is necessary, and the patient moves in, gets the care, moves out. In the private sector, that is very different. In the fee-for-service environment that was mentioned, those costs can just keep on going up. Now, in a potential partnership, as it's spoken of, you've got a legitimate private player. Say, okay, let's say you contract the private sector to do all the laundry services in your hospital. It will do so and obtain a legitimate profit in doing that. There's no such administrative incentive in the public sector, which is why you would require in the public sector local management to manage that laundry. But the contract happens elsewhere. And so what often happens is that these contracts for the private sector, you know, finally they hit a barrier where the public sector refuses to pay any further. And they frequently fail. That doesn't mean they can't occur. And in fact, the way that we had envisaged healthcare would develop over time would be that the private sector provides services at affordable rates, rather than only through one medical scheme system, which, as you know, you pay eye-watering premiums for. And the thing is that because there's also an asymmetry of information in healthcare, you know, that phenomenon of increased volume reducing costs doesn't quite occur. It never occurs anywhere in private healthcare, anywhere in the world. And I think that brings me now to a more fundamental issue. And we must separate health from healthcare. Your healthcare system is at the end of a long chain. That's the healthcare delivery system, public or private. Your health comes from other factors, genetics, environment, social factors, even cultural factors, you know, which all together determine how you maintain your health. And we all know that, and it's very clear now, that greatest healthcare costs come toward the latter parts of life. I love the Stoics and their great philosophy, you know, captured in two words, memento mori. You too must die. And death occurs in the natural course from a breakdown in your health. But that's senescence, okay? That happens at old age. And what you're finding is that aging populations are drawing hugely on health resources, especially in the developed world. However, if all health is determined by social determinants, mainly, and economic, but mainly your social organization, so you need good nutrition, you need adequate shelter, you need access to potable water and clean sewage, you need access to basic education, personal and communal safety, you need those things to work, opportunity for work, safe public transport to get to work. All of those factors determine your health, okay? And when there's a breakdown in any of those modalities, then your health suffers. And that's when you need the healthcare system. So a healthcare system develops in response to that. When you look at your society, what you're able to provide it with, how it's doing, and then along comes something from left field like HIV, and suddenly you are whacked hard with this thing. And then on top of that, you throw in the political denialism that's associated with it, and you compound the problem. So it took us much longer than it should have to sort out the HIV pandemic, right, at great cost. And yet, right now, we can do so at very affordable antiretroviral therapy care. We have 9 million people who are HIV positive. We have 5.4 million, as at the last count, I may be wrong, on routine ARV therapy, living normal lives. The others are not. And that's simply a function, because it was a public function. It was delivered through the public health system, but it met a declining public system as the HIV program ramped up. It met a declining public health system. Now, it's not capable of doing more. And because now also personnel leave. So when you have three doctors in a ward and one leaves, the default position is to cancel the post. And so now they don't fill those two. So now the two doctors are seeing all the patients, three doctors used to see. And it just gets worse and worse and worse. And I think the failure to grasp that, despite 15, 20 years of knowing it, is criminal neglect, you know, for the majority of people.
And we're going to continue this conversation in just a moment, and we're going to look at NHI. I would like to remind you quickly that a new episode of No Ordinary Wednesday drops every fortnight. Please don't miss it. Subscribe to Investec Focus Radio SA wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the channel, please take a moment to rate us. So welcome back. So Letlotlo, let's get back to you then, and let's talk about, I shudder to call it the elephant in the room, but let's use that because I can't think of anything else. Considering the parlous state of our economy right now then, can we afford NHI? And it seems to be progressing ahead with a degree of speed. What is it going to mean for the economy?
Look, Jeremy, in my honest view, and I've written past research on this, is that if the NHI bill is implemented in its current form without any, you know, material changes, it presents a material risk to our fiscus. That is very much clear. If you look at some of the financial projections on which that it's based, you know, 256 billion rand once it's fully implemented. And these are numbers that haven't been updated, you know, for inflation or based on the white paper or projections that are almost in essence more than 10 years old. So if you take into account inflation, you potentially could get a significantly bigger number than 256 billion on an annual basis. And if you're taking that as a percentage of GDP, you could run somewhere in the double digits potentially. And if as an emerging economy to spend that amount of money on healthcare is quite significant. The United States only spends, I think, around 12% of their healthcare costs, which is also quite significant, and they have significant inefficiencies in their economy. So from that perspective, yes, a material, I'd say quantitatively very much a material risk, but also we have to look at it qualitatively as well, because there's a view, it's not only going to impact us from a monetary perspective, but also from a resource perspective, in terms of our doctors, will they in essence be willing to stay? Because at the end of the day, in my view, is that the doctors are the cornerstone or the bedrock of a healthcare service that needs to be delivered, your healthcare personnel in general. In some way, this links very much to my next point of financing of the National Health Insurance, because a significant amount of that is going to come from taxes or general and indirect taxes. And we already know that in South Africa, we have a population that is very much overburdened from a tax perspective. And now from that perspective, if you're going to take away medical aid, tax credits that potentially people get and add, you know, quite significant costs on top of people having to spend on education, on healthcare, et cetera. It doesn't send the right incentives to maintain your cost base. You're already very small tax base from that perspective. So, and we already have, and that tax base is already small. That's around, there's about 24 million people who are registered or should get assessed for tax. But if you look at how many people actually pay tax, it's in low, it's probably around the 5 million people who, for a population of, you're asking 5 million people to finance the healthcare needs of around 66 million, it just doesn't make sense. You can compare it to any of, you know, the NHSs of the world. You know, they have significantly bigger tax bases than ours. So from that perspective, I would say it's a resounding no that we can afford it.
Dr. Aslam Dasu, back into the conversation, please. Do you believe that this concept has failed before it's even started? And is there a better way of doing it? Is there a compromise that will make sure that there is better healthcare for all, but at a more affordable rate?
No. And for a very simple reason. Because the NHI is a political sleight of hand. It's a distraction. It's a deflection from a government that over 20 years has brought one of the best propositions we've had for anything approaching, say, the NHS in the UK, to its knees. It's done that. And in order for it to maintain its legitimacy, it needs money to fix it. The plans are in place, but they won't be fixed. It won't be fixed, not by the provinces. There's no financial incentive for provinces to put the money into infrastructure development. So what do they do? This other 1997 health plan is going along. The Medical Schemes Act is in. Risk Equalization Fund between medical schemes has been worked out. Good research. Our smartest people are behind it. Universities are involved, everything. And so there was going to be a next step. Now we need the supply side sorted out, because you sorted out the funding side. The supply side, regulators, to prevent the perverse incentives from blowing up costs in the private. All of that was underway. 2007, we hear about NHI. By the time this NHI gets implemented, it'll probably be about $700 billion in total. That will have to be raised, put into a fund. Okay? And the way they want to do that is by eliminating all medical schemes and having a single payer run by the government through the SOE model. So the minister will set up a board and a CEO, and they will manage a 700 billion rand fund. You will be allocated a facility, or, you know, of your choice maybe, but you will no longer have any choice of doctor, any choice of facility if you're in the middle classes, and that is what you enjoy with your medical scheme. So you'll call up a call center, I've got an ingrown toenail, and they'll say, okay, you need to go there. You might get sent to the wrong place, but you're dependent on that. And this is a problem. So the entire premise of it was misguided. It was misdirected. It's now portrayed. It starts, huh? It's a noble initiative to equalize. So now you take away your medical schemes. He mentioned the fact about the qualitative issue. That means you get one payer who will tell the doctor, you get paid so much for this. Right now, the doctors have much more latitude if in the fee-for-service environment. In the public sector, they get paid, as I said, a salary. And it's much better now than it used to be. But the way to look at it actually comes from the mining industry. They have their own health services. Their services are organized like the public sector. In other words, they employ their doctors, employ their nurse, employ their staff. They pay them very well. But they are organized in units, like our public sector is. When you go to a public hospital and you get admitted, you are admitted by a unit, the professor, the consultants, the registrar, the interns. You are cared for by all of them. And the chance of something slipping through is very low. But even that, with the pressures they have, things fall through. Now, imagine if they had no such pressures. That's where I would want to go for my care, instead of to a private hospital, which is a hotel facility with 100 separate firms, because all the doctors are independent. Right? And they all bill for their own service. Okay? And that doctor is alone taking care of Jeremy. There you go. And will tell the nurses, I want that. That doesn't mean that the doctor doesn't know what is happening and that you're not properly cared for. But I would still prefer that I'm cared for by a unit where the ward round every morning comes past me and the junior doctors present to the senior doctors. This is the case with Dr. Dasu today, and this is what he needs. And they'll say, no, that's not what he needs. He probably needs that. You know, and I would want that in healthcare, all right? So that's how it should be organized. However, the system, the employer of health professionals of choice and the system of healthcare delivery of choice. The private sector can live in an adjunct next to that, profitably so. Now, this comes out very clearly through the Health Market Inquiry, the most ironic commission of all. There was Aaron Motsoaledi, and then said, this private sector is very expensive and very uncompetitive. Get the Competition Commission to do an inquiry. 6-year inquiry under Sandile Ngcobo, our former Chief Justice, who just captures it in his preamble about the abject negligence of the government in not managing its public system, but more importantly, not regulating the private sector to best practice worldwide. And the private sector agreed in that commission, kicking and screaming, of course, but then saying, okay, yeah, we can live with these regulations. This is what happens around the world. Since that commission, that was, I think, 2016, it finished. Nothing. Public sector's gone into decline. The private sector's grown. So what you now have are a bunch of top-trained clinicians leaving for the private sector. If you have them in the private sector, many of them, I can assure you, will go straight back to the public service if it was properly managed. They will go. And in fact, that's what we need.
Gentlemen, we're coming to the end of this conversation, and I'm going to ask you both for some closing remarks. And maybe the best way to wrap it round, if I can, is firstly, Letlotlo, you've had a look at the situation in other countries. So maybe from your perspective, are there lessons there that can be learned and maybe segue that into the future that you would like to see for this country? And Dr. Aslam Dassou, I'll put the same question to you in just a moment.
I'll say, look, the challenges that we face as a country, you know, from a healthcare perspective are potentially not unique. Because if we look at some of our emerging market peers, the likes of Brazil, Mexico, Thailand, Kenya, for example, countries who still deal with the same issues of inequalities between access. But the way that they're going about it, it's very clear that they're following approaches where you have a mixed healthcare system across both parts, where the public and the private sector work together to deliver healthcare. And a big part of that, in my view, is a lot of these relationships are built through trust. And I think both parties, from my view, both public and private sector, have to, in essence, work together and come to the same table to build that trust first and foremost over the longer term. And I think that's the only way we can get to some sort of or get to a place where we can actually have a thriving healthcare system, in my view. And that is, it all starts with leadership and governance, in my view, in terms of building that trust.
So Dr. Aslam Dassou, the final word to you then. What is going to enable that thriving environment that Letlolo talks about?
Well, first, we must dispense with this delusion, NHI. It comes out of the WHO principle of universal health coverage. Coverage is a financial term. It's an insurance term. And so now you find that the language of healthcare is the stuff of business schools. So you get these middling bureaucrats sitting there in Geneva working this out. Coverage, by definition, says there will be those without cover, right? So let's dispense with that. We have a much more superior formulation in our constitution. It says universal access to all necessary care. Much better, without any impediment. You know, you don't want people to be financially burdened by that access. So now that's your constitutional entitlement. Let's do that. And the way to do that is to dispense with this thing. The private sector must stop walking on eggshells around the government on this. They know that it will hurt them in the private sector, this bill, but they don't seem to understand how bad it will be for the public system. They should stand up and say, Mr. President, don't sign this bill. Do not sign this bill. This bill in its entirety must be sent back to Parliament. In the meantime, do what is logical. If 85% of your population use the public system, spend 85% of your time on that. Fix that. Fix it to the extent that those who don't want to be in private healthcare start migrating backwards. You know, we have such an excellent cohort of health professionals, world class. They sort all over the world. It's a resource, a national heritage. It's not for the government to do with as it pleases, and it's messing that up. So that's what you want in the first instance. And the second instance, say, the private sector must be regulated. There's the recommended regulations in writing. Implement. You do those two things. In 5 years, you have a different healthcare system. And you tax fund. You don't put an intermediary like an NHI fund in your funding of public health. You just create costs there. You tax fund as you are tax funding now, but you make sure it's not stolen, right? So the money must go where it's supposed to go. And then you've got a great system. You don't need anything else, honestly. And you know, if I can get that, if I see that in my lifetime, my 40 years in healthcare and healthcare activism will have been worth it.
To both of my guests, Dr. Aslam Dassou and Letlotlo Lenake, thank you for joining me on this edition of No Ordinary Wednesday. Please join us again in a fortnight as we continue to explore money trends shaping your world. If you haven't yet added us to your podcast feed, search for Investec Focus Radio SA wherever you get your podcasts. Hit the subscribe button. And to get even more insights from Investec, sign up to the fortnightly focus letter at investec.com/newsletter. Until next time, goodbye from me, Jeremy Maggs, and the entire Focus Radio team.
The views expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily represent the views of the firm and should not be taken as advice or recommendations. Investec Limited and subsidiaries, authorized financial service providers, registered credit providers, and long-term insurer.